you ask us to give you a little bit of an autobiography. I guess it's for posterity or for something. Maybe you're just curious about our early days, growing up years, and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm going to attempt to do this morning. Let me see. Before I get involved in myself, I think I'd like to record a little bit about my parents and grandparents, so that you have a little bit of a better foundation. As you know, most of these people come from German stock, German ancestry. My father's mother and father were named Augusta Stock and John Stock. Augusta's maiden name was Wolf, W-O-L-F. Anyway, she was born in Germany, but Grandpa Stock was not. And they, of course, spent all their lives in western Pennsylvania. And I knew my grandfather's mother, who would they called Gross Mom, great-grandmother. And she died about 1924. And I don't know anything about her history, her background, but she was a very nice old lady. Well, anyway, Grandpa and Grandma Stock were very thrifty people, and they were very close with their money, although they were generous to their family. Let me give you a couple examples. When they had some kind of a rainstorm or a windstorm or something, Grandpa would get up early in the morning before he went to work and go around the neighborhood picking up tree branches that fell during the night and stack them all under the back porch. And that's what they used to fire up that stove that was in the kitchen. They did a lot of their cooking on a coal-fired stove, a wood stove, which was in the kitchen. And although they had other means of heat in the house, they lived on Braddock Avenue. It'd be three doors from Melrose Street. Three doors, what would that be? Toward Braddock, I guess. Coming out of Swissvale. Their address was still Swissvale. Well, anyway, they were very, very close and very frugal, let's say. Of course, you have to know their background and their history. They went through a number of depressions, and in those days they called them panics, when the banks failed and a lot of people lost their money. The bank folded up. And, there was no recovery of the funds, that sort of thing. And they had very little faith in banks. They just didn't believe in banks. And of course, they never invested in anything like the stock market. But they were not highly educated people either. And they grew up in the period of time when people didn't have bathrooms in the house, they had them outside. You had an outhouse in the back of the house, and you took a sponge bath in the kitchen with the door closed and all that kind of thing. That was their background. But I know when they lived at this house on Braddock Avenue, they never flushed the toilet until Grandpa went to bed at night, and then he flushed it. So I guess it was flushed once a night, once a day. And, of course, that saved a lot of water. They always paid the minimum. There was like you were charged for whatever water you used, and if you didn't use any at all, you paid a minimum. I'd say something like maybe the first 1,000 gallon were free. And then this schedule kicked in that the more you used, the more you paid. But there was a minimum, gave you so many gallons at a minimum charge of a couple bucks a month or something like that. I don't know what the hell it was. But they were very, very close, very stingy people. They never splurged for anything. No way would they throw money away. Grandpa would walk down to Noble Street, where all the grocery stores were, and he would buy day-old bread and cakes and buns and that sort of thing. Although Grandma baked cookies, and they, you know, they lived a frugal life. They were that kind of people, and they never believed in throwing money away. Well, you know, what the hell? Nobody does, really. But some people have no concept of thriftiness, okay? But these people did. And anyway, I don't know when Grandma was born, but I know she died in 1950, December 4th, 1950. And Grandpa, I don't know when he was born or when he died, because I have no records of that. Although I know that those records are available in some of the genealogy work that's that Mom has and I have, but I didn't bother to look it up. But anyway, that'll be available. Somebody will tell you when he was born and died, but it doesn't matter for this point. Okay, so much for my grandparents. Now, on my father's side, they had three children. My father was the oldest. My Uncle Ray was next oldest, and Aunt Rose was the youngest. So that's about as much as I can tell you about my grandparents on my father's side. On my mother's side, my mother's parents were, of course, Philip Respect and Justine Respect, okay? I know more about those people because I used to work on the farm in the summertime, and I would spend the summers in Meadville, which is where the farm was. But I'll try to give you a little background of those people. Grandpa was born in 1866, June the 2nd of 1866, and Grandma was born August the 26th of 1872. So this was, you know, right after the Civil War period. And I think they were married in 92. I'm pretty sure it was 92, maybe 93. But anyway, Grandpa was born in Ohio, southern Ohio, a place around in the vicinity of Martin's Ferry, and there was another town over there. What was that? Bel Air. Bel? Was it Bel Air? I think it was Bel Air. Well, whatever. Anyway, that was where he was born and raised. Now, he had some step brothers and sisters because his father married twice. And I don't remember that whole family. You know, I've met some of them. I knew some of them. There was Aunt Rose, and she lived in North Braddock. And Aunt Therese, her husband had a pop shop. He bottled pop down on 2nd Street in Braddock. And then when he died, she took it over. And when she died, she left it to a home for boys. And I don't remember the name of the home. I don't think I ever heard it. But the provision was in her will that her son would run it and operate the pop works until he no longer wanted it, and then it reverted to this charitable institution. That's the way that worked out. Well, anyway, then there was Aunt Annie, and there was some in Youngstown, Ohio. But I don't remember all those people. Somebody else is going to have to tell you about them. Well, anyway, then Grandma Respect, she was born in what is now Pittsburgh. At that time, it was the city of Allegheny, which was north of Pittsburgh across the Allegheny River, which is now called Northside. Anyway, she was born up on East Street, not too far from Federal Street. Up in that area, there was a water department reservoir. There was a big tank, and she lived on the street near where this tank was located. I never had an address for her or anything, but when she was down in that north side area as a young person, She was a domestic for the Heinz family, you know, the Heinz ketchup people. So she was like a, how would you call it, a nursemaid to one of the Heinz children. Which one, I have no idea. I have no idea. But that's where she originated. And then Grandpa Respect, he moved to Pittsburgh to get work down there of some kind. He wanted to work in the mill, which paid a lot of money in those days, which was probably 10 cents an hour or something, I don't know. But then that's when Grandma and Grandpa Respect met. And they were married in, I think it's St. Patrick's Church on Liberty Street. Liberty or Penn, I forget which it is. It's right alongside the Pennsylvania Railroad tracks there, going down toward Bloomfield. Well, anyway, that church is still there. Well, okay. I think they were married in 92 or 93. But, of course, Grandpa, he was always a farmer. He was born on a farm, raised on a farm, and that was the thing he did best. When he worked in Pittsburgh, actually, he worked at the chain mill. They made steel chain. I think it was in Rankin. What the hell was the name of that place? American Chain and Cable, I think it was called. Anyway, he worked there for a while. And then I guess his health was deteriorating. The doctor told him he had to get out of that environment or he wouldn't last long. And that's when they moved up to northern Pennsylvania, up in Hayfield Township. Hayfield Township is in Crawford County, and it's north of Meadville on old Route 98, someplace up in there. Well, I was never at this farm, so I really don't know anything about it. And then what happened was he got into the pop business in North Braddock. They lived on Corey Avenue in North Braddock. So he got involved in this pop business. Well, what happened was, when he had to get out of town through some newspaper advertising or something, he found out that these people had this farm up in Hayfield Township, and they just swapped the farm for the business. So they closed up the business. These people come down, took it over, and Grandpa moved his family up to Hayfield Township. Now, the children were small, you know. But, you know, I've kind of lost track of the sequence of events and when they happened. But then he had to move back because they didn't take care of the business or something. So actually, he lived in North Braddock twice. The second time they moved up to Meadville, he lived in Vernon Township. But anyway, like I say, that whole picture is a little bit hazy with me because I'm not familiar with where all he lived and when he lived in these different places and so forth. So I'll tell you about, Pete, Grandma and Grandpa Respect had, I don't know how many children, 10, I think. The oldest was Pete. He was born in 1895. And then there was my mother, born in 1898. And Cleo was born in 1900. And then they followed with Sister Narcissus and Uncle John and Aunt Mary and Bernie and Dolly. Bernie and Dolly, of course, are still living. Bernie lives in Sun City, Arizona, and Dolly, of course, just still lives in Meadville. Then there were a couple children who died. One was Sylvester, and one was... Their name slips me. I should know that girl's name. Well, maybe it'll come to me. But anyway, that pretty much gives you a background of my grandparents. Now, my mother met my daddy in Braddock someplace. I don't know exactly where, but... the church they attended was St. Joseph's Church. Now, that St. Joseph's Church is closed today. That whole Braddock area has now turned into a disadvantaged area. It used to be a hubbub of activity, businesses all along Braddock Avenue from First Street up to 13th Street. And it was, of course, mill-oriented. There was the Edgar Thompson Mill, and across the river was three or four other steel mills, and then the Rankin Works was a border, bordered on the borough of Rankin, so they had some mills down there, and steel was the name of the game, you know, in those days. Well, my mother and father were married at St. Joseph's Church in Braddock. My father went to St. Joseph's Church all his life. He started there in first grade and graduated from there. Now, they had some very strict nuns, and I think that stays with you all your life. Now, the school was run in the German language. All the students were German, descendants of German parents, you know, and so the school was German from opening to closing. Everything was in German. Well, my father sang in the boys' choir, and then he sang in the men's choir. And he sang in a church choir all his life. And he had a beautiful tenor voice, just a beautiful tenor voice. As a matter of fact, any time I ever heard him sing in church, you could recognize his voice immediately. Just beautiful. Well, anyway, where should I go on here? Yeah, I'd follow my notes a little bit here. Oh, okay, well, let's finish up with Grandma and Grandpa Respect. They lived in the country the second time they moved up to Crawford County. And they lived out on what might be called the back road toward Conneaut Lake. There was a paved road and then a dirt road. And they lived from the Y in the road, but where the dirt road connected the paved road. They lived back that dirt road, I guess, one farmhouse. And so Grandpa had land, farmland, and a wooded hillside on both sides of the paved road, both sides of the dirt road, and up the mountain some, I don't know how far up the mountain, but he had livestock in there when I knew him, you know, when I was up in the country. Well, anyway, always had a big garden, always planted corn and grain, wheat, and oats, and I don't think he ever had, that I can remember, any pigs. Now, what happened is he and a neighbor farmer had pigs, I think, together. And the neighbor farmer, whose name was Ed Hoag, I think Ed Hoag raised the pigs, and Grandpa furnished the grain or some damn thing. So I think they kind of split those up a little bit. To raise pigs, you have to have a different fences, of course, and a different arrangement. So, you know, it takes money to build fences and pig pens and all the rest of that jazz. Well, anyway, I guess he only butchered one pig a year, I'm not sure. But they did depend on some of that stock for their meat. I know it that after they moved the second or third time, whenever it was, they lived in Kurtown. They had a big house, a red brick house in Kurtown. And now I know that they had hams hanging in the attic and slabs of bacon hanging up there. And they'd have 100-pound sacks of flour stuck up in the attic there. So they were kind of self-sufficient. They had what they called a root cellar. And that was a cool cellar partitioned off where they kept potatoes and carrots and that sort of thing. They would harvest the carrots and bury them in sand and then dig them out when you wanted them. You know, if you needed carrots, you just went down and sifted out a handful or whatever you needed, and that's the way that went. Okay, they also had a grape arbor behind their house. The house number, by the way, was 1284 Pennsylvania Avenue. Then the post office changed. I think it was 212, and then they changed it to 1284. But anyway, they had a grape arbor behind the house, and Grandpa made grape wine every year, which I never got a smell of. You know, very seldom would I ever see any of that wine. But Grandpa would have some through the winter months. Well, anyway, they never entertained that much that you would serve any homemade wine. Okay, how are we doing here? Now, Grandpa had a Model T Ford flatbed truck, and he used that as long as I knew him. He couldn't learn to shift a gear shift, so he had to use the Model T because it has three pedals, and that's what he grew up with. It's the only vehicle he could drive. And use it for hauling hay, and anything and everything was loaded on that truck. And of course, John by this time was, you know, in the mechanical person, and John kept it running. John and Bernie and Pete, and they all worked on it. But we'll get into that a little bit later. Okay, up behind the house in Kerrtown, Grandpa had he always had one cow, sometimes two. And then, you know, there would be like a calf up there. And I think they raised a calf for meat that butchered in the fall of the year. But I was back in Swissville in school by that time. So I never did get involved with any butchering. Well, I did help a butcher one time butcher a calf. I shouldn't say that. So I did get involved in a little bit of butchering, but not too much. Well, anyway. Where should we go from there? Well, let me tell you about Grandpa's house in Kerrtown. He had one, two, three, four bedrooms on the second floor, one bathroom, had two living rooms downstairs, a dining room, and a great big kitchen. And then they had a sun porch in the back and a pantry. And in the attic, they had a partition. Half of the attic was another bedroom. And they always had the grandchildren sleep up there, or anybody who, you know, couldn't fit in any of the other bedrooms went to the attic. So they had a big double bed in the attic, they always did. And a clothes press, and, you know, it was comfortable. Okay. All right. Okay, now, let's talk about our family, I guess. Let me see. My father was born in 1895, and my mother was born in 1898. Okay, they, as I told you earlier, they were married in St. Joseph's Church in Braddock. They first lived in a little house on Price Avenue in North Braddock, and Price Avenue is not a very long street. But they lived on a little corner house. And then they moved down to the other end of this block of between 4th Street, I guess it was. So they lived then in the first house coming off of 4th Street. If I remember right, it was a yellow brick, nice big house, if I remember. Of course, we moved from there when I was 5 years old, so I don't remember a hell of a lot about it. I know we had a shepherd, no, a collie dog, and we didn't have him very long because some woman came by and the dog ripped her coat, and so they had to get rid of the dog, had to pay for the coat and get rid of the dog. That happened. I remember them talking about it. Of course, I don't remember the incident, but they moved from there to Swissville. McClure Avenue, which is where my mother lived all the rest of her life. And they lived there from 1923, I guess, until my mother died in 77. So you see, that was quite a span of years there. But that was the only homestead I ever knew as far as our people, you know, our family, my family. And I was born in North Brown. I moved up to Swissvale at age 5 and lived there until I left. Okay. Well, let's see, what do we have here? Well, let's talk about my family, my brothers and sisters and so forth. The oldest one is Jack, and I was second oldest. Then there was Ralph. Ralph was born in 1920, and he died in 85. Ed was born in 21, I guess it was. And I don't have Ed's death date right here. Then there was Justine. She's the one who married Al Thomas. They live in Cleveland. And Ethel lives in North Huntington. That's in Westmoreland County. Ethel Nash. And Lenore was my sister who died in 1938. She was born in February 9th of 25. And she died November 29th of 38 at the age of 13. Let's see, okay. And then there was Uncle Bob. You know Bob. He died just recently. And Fred, who still lives in Pittsburgh. And my sister Kenna, who's the youngest in the family. She was born in 34. Okay. Now, you know, I guess you know all your aunts and uncles, most of them anyway. So I won't delve into anything about them necessarily. And so that leads me with nothing else to talk about except myself, I guess. And so you get a little background here of how I came to where I'm at. Now I'm going to stop this for a minute and pick it up later. Well, we're back again. And we reached the point now, I guess, where I'll just tell you a little bit about my own experiences. Born in 1918, of course, December 17th, 1918. And lived in North Braddock until I was 5 years old, 1923. Started school at St. Anselm's Church, or St. Anselm's School in Swissvale in 1924. And went through 8 grades there, and moved across 2 streets to the high school, and graduated from Swissvale High in 1936. Well, you know, the Depression came along in the 30s, the early 30s, and money was very scarce. As a young fella, you know, student, I carried newspapers. Jack and I and Ralph, the three of us, we always had a paper route of one kind or another, sometimes 2 or 3 paper routes. We carried the Sunday paper. We had wagon load of Sunday papers to deliver. Probably delivered, 100, 150 Sunday papers. And we sold papers on street corners, sold magazines. One of the magazines we sold was Pictorial Review, which went bankrupt. They went out of business, I guess, in the late 30s, early 40s. We peddled the Liberty magazine, and I carried papers up until my senior year in high school. I carried 163 Post-Gazettes every morning. I'd have to get up around 5:30. Had to be done by 7, and there was too many papers to carry, so they spotted them around my route. The delivery truck would drop some off at the house, and then he'd spot bundles off around my route, so I'd have to work part of the route and then pick up another bundle of papers and work another part of the route. And the reason my route was so big is because I took over Jack's route. When Jack gave up the Post-Gazette, we had our routes joined each other, so we had like, maybe 25% of the town we covered. But in those days, the paper sold for 3 cents. The Post-Gazette was 3 cents. So the bill was 18 cents a week. And they also had what was called an insurance policy for 2 cents. So you could buy it. Our customers could buy this insurance policy for 2 cents, and then it was an even 20 cents a week. But when I gave that route up, I must have had $150 out that I couldn't collect. People would move or not pay, or you had to chase after them. I was always collecting on a damn route, trying to get enough money to pay the bill. But I was quite successful at it, in the sense that there were a lot of weeks I made more money than my father made. And of course, we had to furnish our own clothing. A good pair of shoes cost you $2.65. A pair of pants was like $1, I guess. And shirts were even cheaper than that. Underwear, they almost gave it away, 20 or 25 cents. Socks were cheap. But anyway, we furnished our own clothing. And in some cases, we'd buy groceries with our money. I know sometimes I'd come home from my paper route, and I'd stop and get a quart of milk and a box of cereal, shredded wheat or something, and have that before I went to school. And what was left over, the other kids later, kids who got up later, they'd have breakfast sitting there if they wanted it. So, we also, at one point in time when my dad wasn't working, we had to have a welfare check. We had to sign up for welfare. Now, you understand, there were 10 kids in the family after Kenna was born in 34. So, with my parents and 10 kids, that's 12 mouths to feed. And our welfare check was $18.75 a week. And that was supposed to cover everything, food, clothes, shelter. We had insurance to pay for on the house. We had a mortgage due. And in those days, the mortgage wasn't very much. I don't know how much it was. We damn near lost the house there once or twice. So we did finally scrape through with everybody helping and working and contributing in the best way we could. In, what year would that be now? Probably 32, 33 maybe. I bought a bicycle, a brand new bicycle. It cost me $26 and some change. Bought it from Montgomery Ward. And the reason I bought it from Montgomery Ward is because my Aunt Dolly worked at Montgomery Ward's in Meadville. So as an employee, she got a 10% discount. So she ordered the bike and had it delivered to our house in Swissville. And so I paid her for the bike then, of course. And boy, that bicycle lasted me a hell of a long time. I guess until I got a car or driver's license, But I put a lot of miles on it, I'll tell you. And let me see what else here. That's the bicycle I took to Meadville. We made a trip from Pittsburgh to Meadville on that bike. And then I went from Meadville to Erie and back again. Did that all in one day. That's 40 miles from Meadville to Erie and 40 miles back. That's an 80-mile trip in one day on a bicycle. Now, of course, they didn't have 10 speeds or anything like that. These were just truck bikes. And we had time to loll around on Waldemere Beach up on Lake Erie. We went up on, Route 19 and come back on 98. So that was a nice trip. And then we took the bicycle from Meadville back to Pittsburgh. That takes 2 days. Can't do that in one day. Well, anyway, that was later on. I don't even remember what year that was. No, that was early, okay. Early in the 30s. Well, anyway, let's see now. Where are we going to start here? I graduated in 36. The first job I got was driving a dry cleaner's truck. Now, you see, I just got my license, so I really wasn't what you'd call an expert driver. But of course, he didn't pay a hell of a lot either, so he got what he paid for. I worked 2 weeks before I got paid. And at the end of 2 weeks, I got $16, if I remember right. And that's 6 days a week, and you work Saturday till you have all your clothes delivered. This was a dry cleaner, tailor shop kind of thing. So I had a regular route, you know, you go around door to door, and you had regular customers, and you'd pick up their dry cleaning and deliver it again a day or two later, whatever it was. So that was one of the first jobs I had. Well, that didn't pay out a lot. In the meantime, Jack was working at Becker's. Becker was a cousin to my mother, Charlie Becker, and he had a Studebaker agency on the Boulevard of the Allies near the Schenley Park Bridge. So Jack was working down there. Well, Jack found out that a fellow by the name of Pat Corbett needed a driver, truck driver, pickup truck, in East Liberty. So Jack sent me to talk to Pat Corbett, and Pat hired me. Now, that job paid $16 a week to start, and that was 5.5 days a week. You worked till noon on Saturdays. And then the guy was nice enough to let me take the truck home for the weekend, so I didn't have to pay streetcar fare or anything like that. So after that happened, I drove for him a couple months before he let me take the truck home. I guess he had to convince himself that I was a responsible person. So then I kept the truck at home all the time. I'd drive back and forth with the truck and made deliveries. Now this was, Pat Corbett owned what was called the Auto Fender and Radiator Company, okay? And in those days, cars were built a little bit differently. The fenders were separate and attachable with nuts and bolts, so you bolted fenders on. Today they're all one piece welded, and so you got a one piece body to work with. But in those days, you could buy a fender and put it on if you wrinkled yours all up. So that's what he did. He handled replacement fenders. And then he had a fellow working for him by the name of Butch Gripner, who was a radiator repairman. So working with Butch, I learned how to repair radiators. And I got just as good as Butch did, you know, as far as repairing radiators is concerned. And I worked there for 2.5 years. So then I decided that I'd like to have a shop of my own. So one of Pat Corbett's customers came in from Gannett, Pennsylvania. I don't remember the guy's name, but he had a Pontiac agency up in Gannett. And if he wanted a radiator repaired, he had to bring it all the way down to East Liberty, which was a hell of a trip for him, you know. So he talked to me about starting a radiator shop up in his garage. Now, he rented from one of the glass companies. Gannett Glass Company had a big warehouse up there. And this one part of the storage area was not used by the glass company, so they rented it out to him as a as a headquarters for his agency. And he had, I think, two mechanics. And he had some new cars, a little bit of a showroom there. It didn't really amount to a hell of a lot. But so I talked to my brother Ralph. What the hell was Ralph doing then? I forget what kind of job Ralph had. But we decided we'd go in business, we'd open a radiator shop in Gannett. Well, I had to buy a few things. I had to buy some torches and an oven. And we had to set up a tank to boil out radiators with Okite, caustic, you know. And so we did all of this. We had to have an airline extended, so we put an airline in. Had to run the gas. We needed gas to boil out radiators, so we put in a gas line from the street in, if you can imagine what that would be like. Dug a ditch and buried 1.25 inches gas line from the street into the shop. And got a meter on the gas line and all that kind of jazz. Well, we did that without borrowing any money. I was going to buy a vehicle, a car, and make a truck out of it so I could haul radiators. So I bought a 1930 Chevy four-door. Cost me $25. and it needed a new flywheel, and the fella had a new flywheel for it but didn't put it in, so he sold me that for a buck. So for $26 I got an automobile and an extra flywheel. So one Saturday I put this flywheel in, so I had a workable automobile. And then I decided I was going to keep the Chevy, because it didn't have very many miles on it. It had a good upholstery on it and so forth. So I thought I'd look around for another automobile that I could cut the back out of and make a truck out of it. So I bought this 1933 Cadillac, four-door sedan, and I was going to cut it up and make a truck out of it. And my dad wouldn't let me. He said, that's too good a car to make a truck out of it. So I kept the Cadillac and drove it around a little bit. Well, anyway, we never did get a truck. We just kept hauling radiators in the damn car. Well, to make a long story short, this was in 1938. Well, anyway, this decided to open this business November 1st, 1938. And boy, we were just sailing along, busier than hell, making all kind of money and all that kind of jazz. And then, between Christmas and New Year's, we had a hell of a cold snap. It was really chilly, really cold, below zero. And I went up on the following Monday to open up this radiator shop, and every pipe in the place had froze up. Busted all the water pipes, and it was very disheartening. So I thought, the hell with it. I'm not going to, you know, the winter's just coming on, see, and I got to look forward to this all winter long. So they don't make rubber pipe for water. So I thought, the hell with it. So Ralph and I decided to get out of the business. So we took all of our tools and everything that was portable. You know, we left the tanks and all that jazz there. And loaded up our... We had the Cadillac then, loaded the Cadillac up with all our tools and equipment, torches, and drove back to Swissvale. So that's like, well, I don't know what it was, probably 30 miles. And we decided we were going to close up the business and go to Florida. Of course, we didn't tell anybody this. So we come home and put the car keys on the mantle, went upstairs, changed clothes, put an extra pair of socks in each pocket, overcoat pocket, extra handkerchiefs, and started a hitchhike out Route 30, thinking we'd go over Route 30 and then down through Maryland. Well, we left, though, I guess it was maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We got as far as Bedford, PA, and decided it's getting dark, so we better find a place to hang and sleep. So there was a place there that said rooms for rent, knocked on the door, and the woman wanted, I think it was $2 to stay in there overnight. So she put us up overnight, we stayed overnight. And somehow Ralph started to get a toothache. Holy mackerel. How the hell do you handle a toothache when you're out on the road hitchhiking? And I think we had, I don't know, between us, we probably had $20, $30, $40, not very much money. And not enough to go to a dentist, you know, and pay the bill. So I said, what the hell are we going to do, Ralph? And he said, well, he said he talked to the family dentist before he left. He'd had an appointment. And the dentist said, if you ever have to have that tooth extracted, you're going to have gas. You should use gas. Well, okay. So we found a dentist that gave gas, okay? And before we went to this dentist office, I said, now, you know, we're going to have to give him a fictitious name and a fictitious address so he can send the bill. So we looked around and we found a street there with a vacant lot, and we figured out what the address, what the house number would be if there was a house in the vacant lot. So we decided that's where we lived. We changed our name. We went up to the dentist's office. And the dentist looked at it and he said, that tooth has to come out. So we gave the girl our names and where we lived and all that kind of jazz. So he pulled this tooth. Well, of course, Ralph's under gas, so he can't You can't just get up out of the chair and leave. They gotta wait till the gas wears off. It's an anesthesia, you know. Nitrous oxide, I guess it is. Well, anyway, after he's able to leave the dentist office, I was down the sidewalk waiting for him. And then we took off and we started to hitchhike south. We got as far as Frederick, Maryland. And, of course, it was, you know, late in the day then. So I said, well, let's stop here at the Salvation Army and have them put us up for the night. So we stopped at the Salvation Army, and this guy said, do you have a ticket? I said, no, we don't have a ticket. Where do you get a ticket? He said, you go to the police station. They'll give you a ticket. You can't sleep here without a ticket. So I said, okay. So we went over to the police station. It's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And there's a whole bunch of bums sitting on the steps out front of the borough building there. And said to one fellow, is this where you get a ticket? Yeah, but you got to wait till the sergeant comes out. Okay, so we all waited, and pretty soon the sergeant comes out, and he hollers, okay, you guys, come on up here and get your tickets. So we went up the steps, and he's sitting behind a desk up on a platform there, looked like a judge, and he said to us, where are you boys from? We said, Baltimore. What are you doing here? Well, I said, we thought we had a job here, but didn't turn out that way. Okay, he said, I'm going to give you a ticket, but by tomorrow I want you out of town. The jobs in this town belong to our boys, so you get the hell back to Baltimore. I said, okay, yes, sir. So we went back over to the Salvation Army with a ticket, and they had like a row house there. And one of these houses was converted into a bunk bed, hostel kind of thing. I think they had 4 bunk beds in the living room. They had a kitchen and 2 bunk beds in the dining room. And there's a big sign on the wall there in the kitchen that said, one night's lodging, cut wood for 1 hour. One meal, cut wood for 1 hour. And I'm saying to Ralph, we'll never get out of here if we get done cutting wood. So the window opened. There was a little window between the kitchen and this other apartment where the Salvation Army man lived. The window opened up and he said, did you boys have supper? No. Well, he didn't say shit. He just closed the window again. I didn't know where we're going to get supper or what's going to happen. So pretty soon the window opened and up comes a tin plate, 2 tin plates, got some black potatoes that looked like they'd been frozen, then boiled. And a little piece of beef of some kind. I don't remember what it was, but it didn't look very appetizing. And I think a cup of coffee. So that was our supper. So I said to him, how about just cutting wood in the morning? He said, we got enough wood. Just leave in the morning. He said, you got to be out of here by 8 o'clock. So, okay, well, we'll be out. So, of course, you know, Ralph and I had never been through this before. We didn't know what the hell to do with our watch and our wallet. So, we slept, put the wallet under the pillow and slept on it. You kept your watch on. You didn't take that off. You didn't have any night clothes anyway, so you really didn't have to worry about that. Took our shoes off. So the next morning we got out of there, and we get back on the highway, walked out to the highway, and we're going to hitchhike. And the first guy stopped to pick us up had a brand new Studebaker, yellow Studebaker pickup truck. And he said, where are you boys going? I said, well, we're headed toward Florida. He said, what are you going to do in Florida? Well, we don't know. We're just going to go to Florida and see if we can find work down there. Well, he said, I could use a couple guys like you if you want to work for me. Okay, what do you want us to do? Well, he said, I'm a milk broker, and I haul milk from Frederick, Maryland down to Washington, D.C., and I need some helpers. I said, okay, it's all right with us. We'll work for a while for it. So he took us to his home, which was in Bethesda, Maryland. Had a great big mansion there. And what happened? This guy had union trouble. And one of his drivers upset his tank truck. He had an insulated, refrigerated tank truck. And the guy upset the damn thing and dumped all his milk down a sewer. So he really, you know, he had to fire all his people. They were union people, and he fired a whole bunch of them. So now he's looking for some drivers. He don't have anybody to drive for him. So what we had to do was, in the morning, we got up at 2 in the morning, and we drove a semi that he had from his house there in Bethesda up to Frederick, Maryland. And then we parked it at the ice house. Then he had about 4 or 5 other trucks up in that area. We'd take these trucks and go around to the farmers and pick up milk from each farm. He had a steak body truck and some cab over engines and so forth. And we'd pick up this milk and bring it back to the tractor, load up the milk, and then we'd load ice, pack it with ice so it would stay cold all the way to D.C. And now this was in January, okay, January of 39. So then after you got all your milk gathered from the farmers, you have to take the semi back to Washington, D.C. and unload it in those 10-gallon milk cans. So when you're done with that, then you have to go home and eat lunch. We normally got out of the dairy at 10 o'clock in the morning. So we'd get back home, eat lunch. Then if there was anything we had to do, like grease the truck or change oil or whatever you had to do that. And then you, by the time you ate supper, you had to go to bed because you had to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. So, okay, we did that. We'd get a bite of supper and everybody go to bed. Well, that went on for a short period of time, no more than a month at the most. And then one day we come back from the dairy. Well, this guy, when we unloaded the milk at the dairy, he said, "I'm going to be a little bit, so just wait for me." So what the hell else could we do? We had to wait for him. And then he came back to the truck, come out of the office, went back to the truck, took the truck back to his house, backed it up to the front door, and loaded that semi with all his furniture. And we took off. Oh, I guess it took us till 10, 11 o'clock at night to load up the furniture. We tied the bed springs on the back after we closed the doors in the trailer. And we took off in the middle of the night. We went up through the back road toward Gettysburg. I found out later that what happens is, you know, he couldn't pay his bills, and he had borrowed money to buy these trucks and couldn't pay for them. So Commercial Credit was the company that he borrowed all the money from for the vehicles, and they're on his ass to get paid. So he had to give up this milk business. I guess he wasn't really making enough money. He was in debt, and he couldn't get out of it. So where he was really headed, although he didn't tell us this, he was headed to his wife's folks' house, which is in Plymouth, Indiana. That's north of Indianapolis. So we finally got there, drove almost nonstop until we got to the mountains coming across Route 30. There were no interstates or divided highways in those days. You just had to take your truck over the mountain on blacktop roads. Well, what happened is a connecting rod went out to the side of the block on this one tractor that we had. He had two tractors. They were both white tractors. One was a big one, one was a little one. So we took the big one, and that's the one that blew the connecting rod out to the side of the motor. Well, we were stuck there on top of the mountain, going up the mountain, really. To make a long story short, we had to get that tractor disconnected from the trailer. We pulled it, backed it into a parking spot. Of course, without the engine, you don't have any air, so you don't have any air brakes. So we didn't have any air brakes after that. So anyhow, we got the truck off the mountain, and he had a pickup truck with him. Ralph was driving the pickup truck, and I was driving a LaSalle. He had a big four-door LaSalle. His wife and kids were in the LaSalle. I think he had two kids. His wife was pregnant at the time, and he was driving the tractor. So anyway, we took the family back to Chambersburg is where it happened. Then we had to take the pickup truck and go back into Bethesda, pick up the other tractor, and bring it out, pick up the family, hook that tractor onto the trailer and take off again across Route 30. We come into Pittsburgh, and then we went over to, I don't know, East Liverpool, Ohio, and then up through, up toward Cleveland and across the top of the state there through Toledo. And we finally got over to Plymouth, Indiana. Well, I think I was like 2.5 days without any sleep. I damn near fell asleep driving, you know, so I finally had to stop. So we did spend a night in a place in East Liverpool. I guess it was East Liverpool. I'm not sure anymore. And then we drove the rest of the way. We got over to Plymouth, Indiana late the next day. So we spent the night at his wife's folks' house. His wife's folks had a lot of money. They had a dairy over there and a creamery, and they manufactured a butter which was quite well known then. It was called Oak Grove butter, and it was widely distributed. But anyway, his wife's folks had a few bucks, a little bit of money. So then the next day we took the tractor and the vehicles down to Westfield, Indiana, which is right north of Indianapolis. So I stayed with him there for a day or so and unloaded the furniture off the semi. And the next day he took me down to Indianapolis, and he said, "I'm going to give you a job here and put you up at the YMCA." So he did. He took me over to the newspaper office, the Indianapolis Star, and a friend of his was an editor there. So through this editor, I got a paper route. It was a morning paper. And he paid my YMCA room rent for 1 week. And that was a couple bucks or something. He gave me $5, and that's the only money I ever got from him as far as wages was concerned, that $5. And I'd worked for him for, I suppose, a month, maybe a month and a half. Well, I carried those papers, and then he got me a job selling investor syndicate securities. So I had to get a securities license, and through some friends of his, I got a securities license to sell securities in Indiana, and I peddled investor syndicate for a while. But I really wasn't, well, I'll tell you what else I did then. I found out there's a radiator shop down around the YMCA, so I applied for a job there. This guy gave me a job repairing radiators at $35 a week, which was a hell of a lot of money in those days. So I had like three jobs. I was repairing radiators during the day, carrying papers in the morning, and selling securities at night. So that was quite an experience. Well, then Easter came along, and I decided, well, I'm going to go back to Pittsburgh for the Easter holidays. So everything you own, you carry with you. You know, what the hell did you have? So anyway, I got to Pittsburgh and spent a day or so in Pittsburgh. And then I thought, well, I'll go up and visit with Grandpa up in Meadville. So I went up to Meadville. And on a Sunday, Grandpa says to me, "Billy said you're crazy to be way out there in Indiana. Your family's here." He said, "I'll get you a job. And why don't you stay here with me?" I said, "Yeah, okay, Grandpa. You know, times are tough. You just don't walk into a place and get a job." So I thought, I'll humor the old man. He can't get me a job anyway. So Sunday after church, he took me over to see a friend of his by the name of Leroy Krause. And Leroy said, "Sure, Philip," he said, "you just have the boy come over to the plant tomorrow morning and ask for me, and I'll take care of him." Shit, I went over to the viscose plant the next morning, and Leroy was there to meet me. He said, "Here's the papers. You take this over to Dr. Winslow, and he'll give you a physical exam, and you start work here tomorrow." I said, "Okay, how about that? Now I got another job." So I had to call the YMCA and tell them I'm not coming back. And I called the other guy, told him I was quitting that job, you know, and so forth and so on. So I didn't have any job anymore, you know, Indiana. So that's the way that went. So then I got working in at the American Viscose Corporation. They made nylon thread. That's what they manufactured. It wasn't nylon. Nylon is a trade name for DuPont. This is Avtex thread, and they've got a whole bunch of other names for it. But it's a synthetic fiber. So I worked there in the labor department for quite a while. And then I got transferred. Then I got a job driving their truck. They had a dump truck that I had to drive that for a while. And then I got into the production department in what was called acid recovery. So acid recovery and acetone recovery are all in the same department. So I got a job working. My boss was Charlie Bell. So I worked for him for quite a while. And let me see here now. What I'm going to do is shut this off and turn the tape over. How do you do that? I want to tell you, there really wasn't much going on at that rayon mill for the next year or so. I had a whole bunch of different kinds of jobs. And I was helping pipe fitters, and I was a helper on a millwright crew, and did all kind of different things over there. And some laboring, you know, just run-of-the-mill things. But I was making, what the hell was I making? 57 cents an hour, I think, when I started out, which wasn't bad. See, I forgot to tell you about my experience on the railroad. Well, we'll get back to that. Anyhow, to make a long story short, I was living in Kerrtown at Grandpa's house. Grandpa had pretty much given up farming by this time. My grandmother died in 38. So Grandpa was working at a... I should tell you that the war started. World War II started. And they built Keystone Ordnance Works, which is out in Greenfield Township, I guess. And it was a plant that manufactured explosives, you know, all the powder. They called it a powder plant. You know, they manufactured explosive powders for shells and artillery and Navy guns and so forth. Well, anyway. Grandpa worked out there, and he was in charge of all the battery recharging. So they had vehicles like you wouldn't believe, earth-moving vehicles. They had a whole fleet of buses, and they came to town and picked up everybody. They had bus routes like a city would have, picking up employees and taking them back and forth to the job. Overtime was no problem. You had all the overtime you wanted. Jack worked out there as a mechanic for a while. The plant right now has been converted into a glass manufacturing plant. PPG Industries makes window glass by the float method. But anyway, that's another story. Okay, so what happened was I met this nice little girl. Her name was Genevieve. And I knew her aunt and her mother, and knew some of their family. But they were just wonderful people. So we dated, and by this time I had an old automobile. What did I have? I had a Pontiac Straight 8 with a leaky roof. The thing here burned 1 gallon of gas and 1 quart of oil. But it got around. It wasn't much of a vehicle, but it got around. And then I eventually traded that in for a 38 Studebaker, which was a much nicer automobile. So anyway, one thing led to another, and darn, we didn't get married. That was in 43. Well, I had been called up for the military, but I failed the exam because I had a bad heart. At least that's what the papers said. I think what happened was Sister Narcissus, who was a big wheel at Spencer Hospital, probably put a bug in the doctor's ear to fail this kid because I was her nephew and she didn't want me going into the Army. I don't know that. I never had that justified or explained. But anyway, I know I failed because I had a bad heart. There's been nothing wrong with my heart for the rest of my life. Either this doctor heard things that he didn't understand, or thought he heard something. I don't know when he listened to Mahart. I don't know what went on. But anyway, I was in 4F. So I wasn't ineligible for the military service. So I thought, well, if I'm not going to the military, I might as well get married, because I wouldn't want to get married if I'm going to be in the military. So we, Jen and I talked about it, and we said, yeah, okay, we'll get married. And so we did in 1943. Married in March. Well, what do you know, what would happen in June? In June, I got a call up for another physical exam. I had to go to Erie this time to be examined by the medical people for a draftee. This doctor says, well, there's nothing wrong with your heart. Whoever told you had a bad heart doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. There's nothing wrong with your heart. He said, I have to put you in 1A, and you'll be drafted like everybody else. I said, okay. Can't fight it, you know, what are you going to do? So then I was called into the service in 43. Okay, so we were living on Walnut Street at the time. I had a little apartment there. And Jen got a job working at the Visco's. She was in the office in the payroll department. So I went off to the military. Let's see, now, I think I took a 2 weeks vacation between the time I left my job and then I went into the service. I think I left for the service around the 1st of July, if I remember right. From there, from Meadville, we took a train out of Meadville and got down to New Cumberland, which is near Harrisburg. That was the induction depot. That's where all the recruits went. All the civilian people went down there and they got your clothes changed into military. Okay, so now you're wearing a uniform. Then from there, they sent me down to Aberdeen Proving Grounds. And I spent all my military career, so to speak, at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. I first went in as an ordnance trainee, basic trainee. Finished basic, and then they sent me to ordnance school, and I learned how to assemble and disassemble the 40-millimeter anti-aircraft gun, the 37-millimeter gun, the 90-millimeter gun. And then what happened, one day at retreat, the sergeant said, I'm going to call out the names here of some people who have to report to the provost marshal's office. I didn't know who the provost marshal was. I thought maybe he sold provos or something. I don't know. Anyhow, it turned out that was the head of the military police. So I reported over there with about six other guys. And this captain said, you men have a choice to transfer out of ordnance into the military police if you want to. He said, there's nothing obligatory about this. If you want to transfer branches and work in the military police here on the post, he said, this is an opportunity. So I thought, hell, I'll be stationed here, you know, as a military policeman. I'll just have a ball here. Okay, so I said yes. So they transferred me out of ordnance into the MPs, and I spent quite a bit of time there. Well, I'll tell you, I spent all my time there until I went to OCS. So that, let me see, I went to OCS in 45, okay, and I was commissioned in December of 1945. I went to OCS in September. So it'd be like, you know, the 90-day wonders. Take 90 days to make you a lieutenant. So after that, I was transferred to a training company. So I was training troops then at Aberdeen until I was discharged. So what happened, the war had ended, of course, in August of that year. And was it August? I guess it was September. So they asked me to stay in a little bit longer, extend my discharge time for 30 days. Well, as it so happened, my old job back at the American Viscose Corporation, they were on strike, so I couldn't get a job if I got out right then anyway. So I agreed to extend my discharge 30 days, and or was it 60, 30 or 60, I forget which. So anyway, then when I did get out, the strike was settled and I got a job. And of course, My seniority at the workplace continued while I was in the service. So when I got out, I was the oldest man in the department because everybody else had come and gone. And my seniority continued. So I had enough seniority to get any job I wanted and any shift I wanted. So I took first shift, of course, and I took the easy job. And I worked that for a while. Well, then I had to find a place to live. So by this time, of course, Billy was born. Billy was born in 44. And I got out in 46? Yeah, I guess it was 46. So there were two houses for sale. I could buy two houses. One of them was a Spanish adobe kind of put together with mud kind of house, and I sure as hell didn't want that. And the other one wasn't finished. It had been remodeled. So I said to Jen, if we're going to buy a house, this is the only one that's available that we can afford. So, okay, we bought that one. Inside, of course, there was no trim. They had just finished plastering the house. So there was no trim on it or anything like that. No trim around the doors or windows. I had to sand the floors. I had to finish a bathroom. I put the bathroom in. And so we moved in there and worked on the house until we could move in. Finally got moved in and so forth. So then I had to finish working on the house, and I was doing plumbing and all kind of work on the damn place. Planted a garden. So we settled down there, and we thought that would be a long-term thing, you know. Then in 1948, I decided I better use my GI Bill. What got me interested in, there was another fellow in the plant who had graduated from Allegheny College, and he had gone under the GI Bill. And a friend of mine, he married a girl in England, and she was teaching German at Allegheny, and he was graduating. Now, he had started at Allegheny before the war, so he had credits accumulated. So I started to think about this college thing, and I thought, boy, I got all that GI Bill time. I might just as well apply for college. So I went up and talked to the people, and, oh, yeah, sure, you're eligible. And they gave me some tests and so forth, and said, oh, yeah, we'll accept you. You can start in September. It's okay. So then I had to change my shift, so I had to get on. I got on, second shift, 3:30 to midnight. And I spent 3:30 to midnight there while I was going to school. But after I got my first year in, now in the meantime, I joined the National Guard because I needed the extra money. You know, you got, $50 a month or something if you attended all the meetings. So, okay. Now what happened is I had to change my branch from ordnance. I was commissioned in ordnance. I had to change my branch from ordnance to infantry to join the National Guard. So, okay, so I did that. Well, what, lo and behold, wouldn't you know, we went out for summer camp in the summer of 49. Or was it, 49? No, it was 50. I had my first year in Allegheny. I finished up my first year, and I finished up one course in summer school. Summer school was two sessions, so I completed the first session of summer school, and then I was supposed to go to Indian Town Gap for 2-week maneuvers. While we were there, they federalized the 28th Infantry. We're now back in the military under federal control, and here I am now, a commissioned second lieutenant in infantry, 112th Infantry, and my schooling had to go on hold, and here I am. So they take us out to Camp Atterbury, Indiana. And I spent a year out there. And then there was a new regulation came through that somebody who had a hardship case, you know, a married man with family and so forth, if they could justify a hardship existed, you were eligible to be discharged. So I got all those papers together, and I got some affidavits from the pastor in Meadville and some neighbors and people like that, and I finally got a discharge under a hardship case. So I got out of the service in August of 51. Yeah, August of 51. I immediately went back to Allegheny College and told them I would like to re-up for continuation of my sophomore year, beginning of my sophomore year. Well, I had to do that in a hurry because school started like the 4th or 5th of September. So they took me back in, and I started my second year at Allegheny in 51. So then I was working second shift, going to school mornings, and studying whenever I had a chance. So I finally graduated in 54, and then I got a job with Westinghouse. A representative of Westinghouse came onto campus and interviewed me for a job in quality control. And a guy from B.F. Goodrich was on the campus, and he interviewed me for a job in the rubber company in Akron. Well, he wanted me in a real bad way, but he said it would be shift work, and I had just had my belly full of shift work. I didn't want to work shift work anymore. So I took the Westinghouse job and went out to Lima, Ohio. So we had to, well, first we rented, and then we sold the house in Meadville. I bought a house in Delphus, Ohio, and paid too much money for it. But that's beside the point. Finally lost money selling that house. Never did make any much money on it. The only way I made money on that house is because, for tax purposes, all the expenses when I had it rented, those expenses were deductible. That's the only way I ever made any money on that house. Well, anyhow, we lived in Delphus for a while, about two and a half years. And then there was a change of people, so I had to go down to, and move down to Bellefonte, Ohio. And I was superintendent of quality control at the motor plant in Bellefonte, Ohio. And then got a letter from Ed. By that time, Ed had moved to St. Mary's. And he was working with the government as a government inspector. And he was talking to a quality control man at Spear Carbon Company who said he needed somebody who had an experience in quality control and so forth. So Ed said, well, I have a brother who's working for Westinghouse in quality control. I'll tell him you're interested if you want me to. He said, yeah, drop him a note, tell him I'm interested. Maybe he'll come over and have, we'll interview him and so forth. So that's what happened. So Ed sent me a note, and I called this guy and told him I'd be over, and we picked a holiday weekend so that I wouldn't be losing too much time. So I came over, and he offered me a job, and I took it. So that's how we got to St. Mary's. Well, I guess the rest of it you know pretty well. I've been in quality control ever since. It's been a real nice occupation. I've had a lot of enjoyment and satisfaction of doing the quality thing. So let me say that if you listen to this, if you have any questions or if you want any more information, just let me know.
Okay, I just want to add a few things here. A few things I wanted to add that I overlooked when I originated this tape. I wanted to let you know that Grossmum, which was my grandfather's mother, John Stock's mother, was buried at St. Vincent's College, at the cemetery behind St. Vincent's College, where they bury all the priests up there. Now, at one time, I think I know she lived in Latrobe, and her parish church was St. Vincent's Arch Abbey Church. They have a name for it, Basilica. Okay, they call it the Basilica. So she was a member of the congregation of the Basilica, and that's where she's buried, behind St. Vincent's College in the college cemetery. Second thing I wanted to talk about briefly, and I've made notes here since I listened to the tape, we talked about how frugal Grandpa and Grandma Stock was. And another thing that I wanted to tell you would show you something about the character of the people. When it came time to paint their house on Braddock Avenue, they went down the cellar and they found all the empty cans or partial cans that had paint in them and mixed them all together. And they would have, you know, whatever colors were there. It would be a little bit like a half a can of this and half a can of that. And some was enamel and some was flat paint and some was green paint and some was whatever. Whatever they had, they mixed it all together, and that's the color they painted the house. And they didn't spend any money for paint that way. Another thing I wanted to tell you was my brother, my father's brother, Ray Stock, was the organist at St. Joseph's Church in Braddock for many, many years. Now, he sang in the choir at the time that they had another organist whose name was, what was his name? Profiter, Adolf Profiter, who was a professional organist, educated and trained in Cincinnati. And he came to St. Joseph's Church in Braddock for, spent many, many years there as a church organist. A great big heavy set fellow. I remember I had to carry him, I had to drive him home one day, and I get in the back of my Chevy, and honest to God, you'd have thought somebody dropped 5 ton of potatoes in the back of the car. It just sank right down to the helper springs. But anyway, I got this guy home. He must have weighed a hell of a lot more than most people weigh. But old Adam was, Adolf his name was a hell of an organist. And then Ray took the job over when this guy either quit or retired or died or whatever happened, I don't know. And Ray was the organist for most of his life. And he, of course, had a good choir, and he had the children's choir, he had the adult choir. But that church, of course, was his life, because he'd gone through all the grades there, and he knew the church and the school inside out, and it was just a part of his life. And when he got too old to play, then his daughter, Mary Rose, was organist down there for many years herself, and then she finally quit, and they closed St. Joseph's Church, which I've told you earlier. Another point I wanted to just tell you briefly is I worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad for 3 months. And that was back in, what the hell year would that have been? I got out of school. Okay, what happened was, I told you I drove a truck for a dry cleaner. It's called Serve Us Dry Cleaners. And one day I found out that the railroad was hiring up in Pitcairn. So at this time I had a helper on my truck. There were two guys assigned to this truck. I was the driver and I had a helper. So I said to my helper, I'd like to take today and drive up to Pitcairn and apply for a job on the railroad. And this kid says, that's a good idea. I'll go with you and I'll apply for a job too. So I went up there and went to the employment office and talked to a fellow there. He was in the employment office, and he's come over, and he said, he walked with a limp and a cane, and he said, can I help you boys? And I said, I'd like to fill out an application to work on the railroad. He said, see those file cabinets over there? He said, they're all filled with applications. He said, we have so many applications that you'll probably never hear from us. And I said, well, I'd like to fill out an application anyway. Okay, so he gave us each an application to fill out, and then we put down all the basic information, your name, address, and all that jazz, and turned it into him. Didn't hear any more, of course. Went back home, and at the supper table that night, I was telling my dad that I'd been in Pitcairn and applied for a job on the railroad, and he said, did you see Porky up there? And I said, I don't know Porky. Porky who? He said, well, this fellow, did he walk with a cane? I said, yeah. Oh, he said, that's Porky. He said, he only lives over here on Hanover Street, which was one block away. He said, if you want to work on a railroad, I'll call him up. So he got on the telephone. He thought, hey, Porky, he said, this is Fred Stock. How are you? He said, my boy was up to get make an application for a job on a railroad. And Porky said, why the hell did you tell him, the kid, to tell me who he was? He said, I didn't know who he was. So he said, send him back up tomorrow. So I went back up the next day. And damn if I didn't get a job up there working on a railroad. So I was laboring, you know. The only job you have is an entrance job. It was paying 40 cents an hour. My job was to clean out the boxcars so they could use them again. If anybody received a shipment in a boxcar, they left all the paper and the dunnage and the 2x4s and all the other jazz in the boxcar when they were done with it. So our job was to clean out the boxcar and get it ready for the next user, whoever that happened to be. So that was a laboring job, paid 40 cents an hour. Then from there I got working over on the heavy side, which was changing the wheels and the axles and the brakes and all that sort of thing. And they have to jack the cars up to do that, of course, and you have to take out what's called the truck. And the truck is a set of wheels and springs and axles that all come out under the car, and they're, of course, rest on a bearing and a central hinge pin that sticks up in the air, and that goes into the bottom of the railroad car. So that whole assembly of the wheels and axles and springs and that whole assembly is called a truck. So you take the truck out and you overhaul it and you change wheels and axles and brakes and all the rest of that jazz and springs and spacers, and you do all that jazz. So I did that for a while. And then I was transferred up to the steel shop, and we were building cars up there. Then we were building box cars. And my job there was to, I had a number of jobs. We put lining, the wooden lining inside of box cars. We put floors down and all that kind of jazz. And then I had a job when they would disassemble a box car. What they would do is they had a torch, a guy with a torch, a cutting torch, and he'd cut the parts all apart in the car. And my job was to pull the different steel parts out from under the his feet so he could keep working. And every time he'd use his cutting torch to cut out a piece of metal, why, I'd have to pull it away and stack it where it belonged and so forth. So that was just a laboring job too. And then from there I was transferred down to the 32nd Street Powerhouse. Now the 32nd Street Powerhouse, I was in Pittsburgh. I was on Liberty Avenue. That powerhouse supplied steam and compressed air and I guess some electricity for the railroad yards. Now the Pennsylvania Railroad yards ran from, well, I would say about 32nd Street, all the way down into the main railroad station, which was down by 7th Avenue, I guess. But anyway, those were the railroad yards, and all between the tracks and so forth, they had compressed air and steam, in case a passenger train came in, and if they disconnected the locomotive, then they had to supply steam and heat for the railroad cars in the wintertime, in the passenger cars, so you keep them heated. And that's what the steam was all for. So they had a powerhouse there. And my job was to empty railroad cars of coal so that they could fire the boilers, and my other job was to haul out the ashes from underneath the boiler. So we would burn something like, I don't know, a railroad car full of coal a day or something like that. And that was another one of my jobs. But when I left there, when I left the railroad, I went down to Philadelphia and then to Washington, D.C. And what I originally intended to do was to get a job or sign up for the military. Actually, I was going to try for the Navy or the Coast Guard or one of those services. But I dropped out. I flunked that out of kind of my eyes. And they said I had astigmatism in my eyes and all that. But there was just an excuse because they weren't taking any recruits. You know, in those years, in the 30s, they had so many people who were trying to get into the military only because it was like a meal ticket. They weren't interested in the military. They just liked to have three full meals a day. So anyway, it was tough to get in the military in those days. Another point here I have, I made a note I wanted to tell you. When I got out of the service in 1946, I got a job working mornings. Well, actually, I started working all day, but that didn't last long because I got my other job back. But anyway, I worked mornings for a guy by the name of Lou Mason. And he had a radiator shop up in Meadville. And I worked for him for, I don't know, probably a year, from 8 in the morning till noon. And then I would go into work at the American Viscose Corporation at my regular job from 3:30 to midnight. So I repaired radiators for Lou for a long time. And I knew Lou. I've kept in touch with Lou ever since. Okay, so that takes care of that. Now, the other thing I wanted to tell you was, we mentioned all of my mother's people, the Respects, who lived in Meadville. They all went to St. Agatha's Church. They were all members of St. Agatha's Church, and they're all buried in St. Agatha's Cemetery. So if you ever get up there, you can see the names of all these people we're talking about on headstones. Now, that includes, of course, Jen's family and my ancestors. They're all buried up there. Another point I wanted to tell you about was in the late 20s, Grandpa Respect Runnin was not only a farmer, but he also, he had to have something for these boys of his to do, Pete and John and Bernie and so forth. And so he built a little building, a garage building, sold gasoline. He had an agency for Ford cars, Ford trucks. He had an agency for the Lexington, which was an earlier automobile, and the Garner, which was an earlier automobile. So he sold a number of those vehicles as an agent. And of course, these guys, John, Pete, and Bernie, they worked on the cars and maintained them and so forth. And of course, they didn't have an inspection in those days, and cars were much simpler in those days than they were today. Believe me, there just wasn't as much to an automobile in those days. And so he had this dealership, and my Aunt Mary, she ran the books. And of course, Grandpa, he never fixed a car in his life, so he didn't know nothing about fixing a car. But he provided employment for the three boys in the family. And then he sold that eventually to two people by the name of isn't that funny, I can't think of that. Malpe and Morrissey. Mr. Malpe and Mr. Morrissey bought the dealership from him. And then, of course, he was out of that altogether. And let's see, another thing I wanted to tell you. The guy that I worked for in this milk brokerage business from Bethesda, Maryland, when we left Bethesda to move out to Indiana, that guy's name was Clarence V. Dye, D-Y-E. Not that you'll ever meet the fella. He's probably dead by now anyway. But that was the name of the guy that I worked for. And the other thing I wanted to point out to you was, when we had that truck failure on the mountains, across Route 30, when that truck failed up in the mountains, of course, I related to you how we got it out of there. We went back to Bethesda, pick up the other tractor, and hooked onto the trailer, and put the tractor with the defective engine in a garage, and then we left from there. We stopped in Pittsburgh, stopped at our house in Swissville, really, with this semi, and we had the pickup truck, and the semi, the pickup truck, and we had this LaSalle four-door sedan with his family in it. Okay, so we had three vehicles. Now, there was Ralph and I and Clarence Dye and his wife, okay, all four drivers. When we got to Pittsburgh, Ralph decided not to go to Indiana with us, so he stayed at home. So there was Clarence Dye and his wife and I who took these three vehicles out to Indiana. Okay, so you get that straight. And that pretty much concludes the notes I have here that I just wanted to touch base with you on, so that you have maybe a better understanding of what was going on. So that pretty much concludes, and if I think of anything else, I'll add it later. Okay? Good luck, and if you have any questions, let me know. Over and out.